Notice that we made the circle bigger so everybody back there would have seats and nobody's sitting up front yet. Must be alcoholics in here. Guy back home used to talk about herding sheep when he was younger in his life and all that. And he'd talk about those sheep that wouldn't stay up with the herd. They'd get out to the back, get out there by themselves so the coyotes could pick them off. He says, coyotes is spelled W-H-I-S-K-E-Y. Bob and I noticed here during the break that we were talking to a couple of us here that have some sobriety and have had sobriety and have tried the deal and nothing's working. And everything seems broke. One of them's at 7 years, and Bob and I have heard for years that there's that 7 years we all go through a trial. And at this point, what have I've gone through 6 7-year periods in my life, and it didn't really strike me. I thought I was being selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and frightened. I didn't realize that was predisposed for me to happen that way. But it does seem to be. I'm not making fun of that, really. But the process has been the same for me every time I was in trouble. So, unfortunately, when we do these things, we can make it, Bob touched on it earlier, we can make it sound like this is all we have to do and we're not going to deal with life as it hits us. I don't know that I believe in the saying that we deal with life on life's terms. I think it's trite, it's not necessary too, but we can deal with life on God's terms if we stay in the middle of this thing and deal with our unmanageable lives, because they've come unmanageable again. The mistake I would make was now that I've got the steps behind me, that must mean I can manage my life. And I don't know, not many people have read the book any more times than I have, or any more carefully, but I can't find where the book says, now you can go out and manage your life. Have you found that? I didn't think so. But we can start believing that. But it's really not there. If we're living a spiritual life, God has to set aside. Years ago, at the Diggs meeting, a guy came into the meeting that he was a regularly attender, but he never said anything. And back then at the Diggs meeting, the big book would be sitting on the table. And if somebody had a subject they really wanted to talk about, they had to become chair. And they did that by getting there first and grabbing the big book and helping set up the meeting. And one day this guy came in and he did that. And he grabbed that book and he sat down. And so he opened the meeting and got the prayer and the business done. And he said, I'm in real trouble. And he says, I got to share it with you. I think I'm getting sicker in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, I watch people and I talk to people, including the sponsor, which wasn't me. And he says, I find out that there's one big thing you guys are doing or doing differently than I have. And I think that's it. He said, I have been on Prozac for all these years. And I think at that time he might have been 5 or 6 years with that. And I'm getting sicker. I'm getting worse. And I want to just hear some comments on that. He says, you can tell me whatever you want. You know, you're not going to make me feel any worse than I already feel. And so it went around the room. And he got somebody that commiserated with him. And then he got old Red, told him to reach way down, stick his head between his knees and kiss his ass goodbye because he was screwed. Then it came to the priest. His name was Larry. He just died 6 months ago, an old friend of mine, a big book guy. And he says, well, he says, I guess you got a decision to make. And he said, the decision, he thinks, is if you really feel like you must manage your life, that means you can't live a spiritual life. If you have to, because a spiritual life means we give up management of our life. But he said, in your case, if you must manage your life, then you better take the Prozac. And that's the honest answer that I've ever heard from anybody about dealing with those things. If you feel that's what you must do, then do it. But it's really going to conflict with trying to live a spiritual life because you're managing your life. And so the rest of that story went on that that man did, with the doctor's help, get off the Prozac, did all that, and went back through the process of going back through the steps again. We're talking probably 20 years later now. And you see him now, and he's a very effective 12-step person in AA. He will thank us every time. If the telephone answering service wakes him up at 2 in the morning and they say, "We don't think this guy is too drunk to 12-step, but he certainly needs help." He doesn't care if he's too drunk to 12-step. He's going to go check him out and see if he needs to go to the hospital or do what it is. And he'll thank us for the call every time. He'll send us a note thanking him for that. And he may, without identifying who it is, he may drop a note and tell how the guy's coming along, how he's doing with that. So anytime I'm not trying to live the spiritual life because I can't manage my life, I'm in trouble. The reason I know that is I got 45 years of doing that off and on, and it's been my case.
So let me say something about this 7-year deal. Because you don't want to make that a self-fulfilling prophecy. But it's not unusual for people to reach, and I'm talking about step workers. You know, people who don't engage in a recovery program are going to hit a crisis point at some point. No telling when that's going to be. It can be 30 days. It can be 20 years. But they will hit a crisis point just because they're staying as crazy as they were when they came through the door. What I'm talking about here is, and it doesn't have to be 7 years either. It can be like 5 years. It can be whatever. But it is not at all unusual for people who are practicing the recovery program, doing the 12 steps, to hit a point in their life. And we used to call it a cusp. But I don't want to sound metaphysical here. There's a point in your life when everything just goes to hell in a handbasket. And, you know, for me it was at 7 years and all of a sudden I got a divorce. I mean, my wife just said, "That's enough." And my business almost went bankrupt. I got sued for $4.5 million by an ex-business partner. My kids stopped talking to me and my car burned up. And it all happened in about 6 weeks. And I'm sitting there thinking I must have really pissed God off. And I didn't know how I did it. And you know the guy that Gary talked about, that they called Big Frank. The reason why I call it, well, he was drafted by the New York Football Giants. He was a very large man and extremely argumentative and an attorney. And I went in there and he said, "What's going on with you?" And I told him, and he looked at me and he said, "What's the matter? Somebody change all the rules, Bob?" And I always thought he spoke in riddles anyway. And he explained to me that it was fairly normal for step workers to run into that kind of impediment at some point in their sobriety, usually around where mine occurred. Well, all that stuff went on, and everything I knew how to do didn't work. I was still 10-stepping. I was still doing 11-step. I was still writing inventory once a year. I was still doing all this stuff, and nothing worked. Actually, it did. My perception was that it didn't work. And you get right in the middle of it, and you truly feel, I don't know what other word to use except forsaken. And I'm thinking God went on a long vacation and that I was going to belief that's real common around Alcoholics Anonymous is, if it's like this now, it's always going to be like this. Well, that's just bullshit. If it's like this now, it's never going to be like this again. That's the truth. Everything changes all the time. We're like moving objects on a moving plane, and things are going to change no matter how imperceptibly they change. So, and what happened was that I had to change my mind about a whole lot of things, and because I'm so pig-headed about wanting to believe what I believe, it was a serious job for God to get me to change my mind about a whole lot of things that I had to change my mind about. And the only thing that would drive me to changing my mind was pain. We used to hear these self-righteous bastards in AA say pain is the touchstone of growth. Oh, good. Go fuck yourself. You know, actually it is. I've heard an awful lot of things that I didn't want to hear but were the truth from people I didn't like. And he was one of them. And so anyway, what we really want you to understand is that it's not unusual to hit some sort of crisis point on what seems eerily like regular periods, like 5 to 7 year periods. Because it just happens that way. If the longer you become sober, the more you really see yourself as an observer. And you watch all these people, and because you have a clear mind because of your sobriety, you start going, what's going on here? And so if those things happen to you, don't let them scare you. We all suffer from faulty perception, and this in some cases turns into a massive case of faulty perception. So don't let that scare you. Just keep doing what you're doing. You know, I watch people wander off at that point in their sobriety and drink again. And I was asking this Frank, so what do you do in the middle of this? And he said, just keep doing what the book suggests. So I kept 10-stepping, kept 11-stepping, kept writing inventory once a year, kept working with others, and just acted, you know, like I need to follow the directions no matter how it feels. See, we used to have feelings can really be the enemy because they're so closely tied to your ego. And, you know, we had an expression around Denver for years which was fuck your feelings. Okay? It just, your feelings,
it's people. Another Frankism too, huh?
Yeah. They're not the barometer of your spiritual growth. So if you try and decide your spiritual condition by how you feel, you're making a mistake. They're not connected. Your feelings are attached to your ego. All right, so should we talk about the third step? Does anybody want to ask a question about one or two? Yeah.
Exact same thing, Dan?
Yeah.
You might want to come say this to the mic if you're going to share something to the whole group. They can't hear you.
My name is Dave Marquez, recovered alcoholic. What I was saying is that I went through this about from 8 to 10 years sober, and like Bob said, just kept doing everything, and nothing seemed to be changing, just seemed to be getting darker and darker. And when I finally came out on that, one of the core mistakes that I was making was that I had started dictating to God what a spiritual basis of life was supposed to look like, feel like, and how that was all supposed to go. And had no and I don't know, and how I felt was a barometer of my spiritual condition and my sober life. And nothing could be further from the truth. And I got to a place where I was worshiping God's gifts, but I wasn't no longer worshiping God. And so when the gifts weren't showing up, which I thought that they were supposed to be, and how that was supposed to feel and how that was supposed to look, I thought God disappeared. And he hadn't. And so that was just my experience with that, and I just wanted to touch on that.
So let's talk about the third step. I'll tell you about my experience with that. I mean, I was still reluctant to get too deep spiritually, and I was reading a book with my sponsor, and he had me read the third step prayer, and he said, "Do you know what that means?" And I said, "Well, I think I do, but tell me what you think." And he said, "Okay, where it says, 'God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt,'" he said, "there you're giving God a blank check, and God gets to do anything with you that he wants, no matter how you feel about it." And I'm going, okay. And then it says, "Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will." I truly am bound to myself. It's like I'm chained to myself. All I can think about is me. Even if I'm thinking about you, I'm thinking about what effect you have on me. Take away my difficulties of victory over them, may bear witness to those I would help. Bearing witness means being an example. Let me be an example of what happens when someone tries to get close to God. May I do thy will always. So he said, "I want you to go home and think about that for a week and come back. And then I'm going to ask you to get on your knees and hold hands with me and say that prayer and mean it." That was the worst thing he could have done. I mean, I sat there and had that, "God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt," running through my head for a week, going, "What's he going to do?" And this was before, I had gotten to the third step before the 14 of us got together as a group and went through the steps. So I went back to my sponsor's house, and I'm sitting there, and he said, "Well, you want to do your third step?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Then I can't help you." And I said, no, you misunderstand. You asked me if I wanted to do it. I don't want to do it, but I will do it." And he said, "Okay, then get on your knees and hold my hands and say the prayer and mean it." And I did that. And when we got up, he kind of laughed, and I said, "What's so funny?" And he said, "Why didn't you want to do the third step?" And I said, "I didn't want to give God that kind of power in my life." And he said, "That's why I left." And I said, "I still don't understand." And he said, "God's got all the power anyway. This is just an exercise in who's God and who's the drunk." I did not want to do that. And you hear around AA a lot that God takes that decision a lot more seriously than most people in Alcoholics Anonymous do. And if you're going to ease, or if you're going to do it in any manner, and say that prayer, you better be ready, in my experience. Because something's going to happen. The book says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem. And it talks about driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity, and all that stuff. When someone told me, actually when Don told me, that my problem, that alcoholism was selfishness and self-centeredness. And, you know, I looked at him and I said, I'm not really that thick. But I looked at him and I said, what is that, some kind of Zen thing? And he said, no, that's what alcoholism is. Selfishness, self-centeredness, or selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And that's what alcoholism is. And I said, it doesn't make any sense. And he said, when you write inventory, you'll find out that that's the basis of your disease. And, you know, I don't just write inventory every year. I start at step one and reconsider it. And we probably should have mentioned that. But, you know, if you're gonna go through the steps, you take a first step again. And you have to ask yourself that same question. Am I really an alcoholic, or have I been deluding myself for all these years? And do I really believe that there may be a God? And am I really willing to turn my will and my life over to the care of that God? Now, the book talks about being on a new basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. You know, most people just agree with that. They don't actively pursue that. Will you turn to God in difficult times, or will you try and solve the problem yourself? Are you willing to turn to God on any occasion other than the one where you have exhausted all your other resources? Are you willing to ask for help? See, most of us, well, I shouldn't say that. I know I am. I'm one of those people that just wants to take care of it. And it has taken me decades to find out that it's a hell of a lot easier to just say, God, I'm over my head. And I need you to intervene here because I have no idea how to.
Just kind of going on with that, it seems like I got to get out there and scratch for a while before I'm going to reach that point, though. I don't, that doesn't come to me first. And I don't think it does for a lot of us. The reason I say that, just real briefly skipping a bunch of us 10th step together, and be amazed how many times I'll get a call or I'll call somebody else and start whining about everything that's going wrong and all that. And if that person I'm calling is on his toes, he'll say, oh, you must not have asked God to remove it. Because that's the first thing the 10th step tells us, you know. At once, ask God to remove it. But I haven't done it, so I seem to go through this period of trying to fix it myself before I end up turning to God. Just being candid with you, that seems to be what I do. The way it's written, maybe we don't have to do that, but that's certainly been my experience. I had gotten to the third step when we were all doing it in the book. It was my real first experience with it, with being faced with it. And when it was suggested that we were to read/pray the third step prayer together, something in me just died, because, God, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to get up and say a prayer with 13 other guys and hold hands. Maybe it was what I didn't like. But the discussion was, and the reason we did it is because one of the guys in the room had been to a number of meetings on inventory before that night we met. And he would go up to people after the meeting and ask them why they hadn't started writing an inventory yet. And a few of them said they hadn't taken a third step yet. So Lee said, why don't we read / pray the third step prayer together while we're holding hands? And he says, that way, if a couple of weeks from now you hear me telling somebody I've not written an inventory yet, you can call me a damn liar because you saw me do it. At least I understood that. That made sense to me. And so we did, and we just went through the process. I didn't have it memorized at that point. I had to read it, and that seemed to be fine. I still think I did part of that because everybody else was doing it. I didn't want to be the odd man out. But we did, and after that meeting, I'm in the car going home, and I asked God to make it real. I said, I can't live like this any longer. This prayer has to work for me. Please do that. I can give you a couple experiences that happened around this time in my case. The first thing that Bob touched on is Eddie went out after that and drank and froze to death in a doorway down on Larimer Street in Denver, Skid Row. But along in there at the same time, I'm at another meeting, and this guy, Frank, that Bob and I talk about, was sitting there, and nothing spectacular in the meeting happened, but I had been, shortly after I think we did the third step prayer together, and I end up sitting down in his meeting next to Big Frank. And at the end of the meeting, everybody said the Lord's Prayer and said, and I sat back down for a minute, and he sat down as close to me as Bob is here now. And we just sat there for a minute, and he didn't say anything, and I finally said, you know, Frank, I'm really tired of trying to compete with you or win your favor or all that shit. I said, I just think you're another blanking alcoholic, and that's all I want you to be in my life. I said, you got that? And the big son of a bitch laughed out loud like crazy, reached over and hugged me, and I thought he's going to kill me right there. And just huge. We left and we went home. That particular night at my house, that was an early meeting I would go to on occasion because Julie wanted to go to an Al-Anon meeting that night. And so she would put the kids to bed and kiss them goodnight and leave, and they'd be left alone for maybe 10 minutes because she's going to the meeting and I'm coming home. And I came into the house, I went in to kiss the girls goodnight, I went from third to first to second in this case, and I went into the second oldest daughter, Patty, and she's laying in there crying. She had been diagnosed with ulcers as a young child. She really had them, and they were bad. And she said her tummy hurt, I said, do you want some milk? She said, yeah. So I went down and got her some. I came up, she's drinking the milk. And I'm working for a bunch of lunatics at this time. It was a business owned by some Pentecostal people, tongue-talking Christians, who were swearing that I wasn't sober because the only way I could be sober is if Christians were praying for me. That's the only way it'd work. And that didn't happen. The people who were praying for me didn't know what that was about at all and all that. But they would talk about people being healed as a result of prayer. And so I thought, well, I don't know what else to do. Nothing else was working for her ulcer. And so we sat down there, and I said, it was as uncomfortable for a thing for me to say as talking to Frank had been earlier that night. And I said, Patty, shall we ask God to help you with that? And she said, yes, please. And so we held hands here, and I put my other hand on her stomach, and I said a prayer. I have no idea what I said. I got no clue what I said. And when I was done, I didn't pray long. I still don't pray a long time out loud. And And I look at her, and she'd gone to sleep. She was sound asleep. And I went downstairs, and I just sat there, and I had this overwhelming feeling of the presence of God. That had been in the car going home after Frank tried to squeeze me to death. And that went on for quite a while. And then several months later, that same summer, Julie's fixing dinner one night, she was making a Mexican dinner, and a big old new pot of green chili there and all that, and we all just love it. And the oldest girl said, "Well, what's Patty going to eat? She can't eat that anymore." And Patty said she can too, that her tummy hadn't hurt her for a long time. And she'll eat as much green chili as I can today. I just share that with you, but that was my experience around the third step. And all I did was agree enough. Well, I got a fly really likes me. Go get him. He's over there.
I've got my own.
Oh. but that was really a jumping off place for me for to get going, because everything fell into that place right there, and it gave me some momentum. And when it came time to write inventory and do those things, I knew I had it. And I called it momentum. I didn't call it God. But whatever it was giving me that shove to go ahead and get it done. I have found pretty much the third step to be that easy for me, effectively, every time I've done it over the year. After I've taken a hard look at steps one and two, and gotten to that, there doesn't seem to be anywhere else to go but to say that prayer again. And I almost do with other people every time. And I guess we can ask y'all if you want to do that. Anybody here feel like they would like to read/pray that third step prayer together? Anybody not want to? We'll get you. That's a setup, okay. But you don't have to. You won't have to. We don't have to get up or jump down or do anything. If you want to grab hands with who's next to you, that's up to you guys. Gone?
Take away my difficulties, have victory over them, and bear witness to those that have come. Thy power, thy life, and thy life, and to their goals.
We didn't have a lot of time to talk about inventory.
We started then, we got time. How did we start? We started at 10:30. We got until 1:15. What time we have left on this? Where are we at? This session goes till when?
11:45.
11:45. I thought we had a half hour.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I can tell you that I came to the conclusion that I wanted to see God as a father from the very beginning, because I was asked that question. And I've never changed my mind. Now, the whole idea about... there's a theological argument that if you understood God, you'd be God. If God is really the way he's described, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, and all those things that have no boundaries, then it's beyond my comprehension to understand God. no matter what I conjure up about God, it's insufficient. All I can do is put an image in front of myself and worship that, understanding that I can't know God. I can just know the manifestations of God. I hope I'm not speaking in riddles here. So I understand that God is beyond my comprehension, and I like the idea of the Father. So my image of God is the Father, and I understand that God is whatever He is. And it's going to be a mystery to me for my whole life. So I don't bother my mind with the whole idea about having to understand God before I'll believe in God. I just believe. And my experience is that there are things that continue to happen in my life that have no other explanation except that there is a loving and gracious God and that He cares about me. And so the other day we got a new lady in my home group named Stacy, and I was telling Gary on the way over here, a guy that I've sponsored for about the last 15 years, not too long ago, he found out he had COPD, and right on the heels of that, he found out he had Hep C, and that he was probably going to have to take those interferon, whatever, treatments. And then he got really sick about a week ago and hasn't been out of bed since then. His daughter had a baby, had a premature birth baby, and the baby was alive for like 4 days and it died yesterday. And the Stacy had talked and called me and said, "Did you hear that Jack's grandson died?" And I said, "Yeah, and there's something I want you to do." And she said, "What's that?" And I said, "I want you to watch him like a hawk." And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Because I need you to watch what happens when someone who lives by spiritual experiences or spiritual principles experiences those kinds of horrific circumstances in their life. Watch how he walks through that with a measure of dignity that you wouldn't believe." So, thanks.
You were referring, Mike, to the place in the book, well, that's loud, where, as I see it, Bill was really trying to put down some simple concepts. He didn't want us to complicate it with any old ideas that we may already have or something we've picked up from watching other people or that. He said that he's the Father, we are the Son, he is the principal, we are the agent. He just wanted these simple things out there. And anytime I've read those, and I lucked out, I guess. Somewhere I caught on that if I had a concept of God, I would be screwed. I couldn't do it. And somebody went along with, "How about a loving spirit?" And that works. You know, I caught on. Somebody told me that God can't be anything but love. He can't do anything else. And that's all I needed to know with that. And I have spent a lot of time experimenting with God and reading a lot of books and doing stuff like that. But I don't know that concept's ever completely changed, no matter what I called him. Pretty well ridden with that. Now we can start on the inventory, I think.
Okay, if you're going to do the inventory out of the book, which the really compelling reason is how we make a list of persons we'd harm. The statement in the book is we did it when we took inventory. And if you don't write your inventory out of the big book, you aren't going to have that list. Most of the time, anyway. Every guide I've ever seen didn't really solve that problem. So it asks us this. It asks us to write down people, institutions, and principles that we were angry with. It talks about a grudge list. And it says, in the first column we put the name, in the second column we put the cause, and then in the third column it says that we ask ourselves, did it affect my self-esteem, my security, my ambitions, my personal relations, my sex relations? And some people will put pocketbook in there, but I put that under security, which is part of security, which is financial security. And then it asks us to go back through the list and write down where we were selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. I got to tell you, see, that sounds pretty clear, pretty definite. But if you talk to people in other groups a lot, you'll find out that people start heading in different directions when they start defining self-esteem, security, ambitions, personal and sex relations, and they'll use different definitions. I'm one of those people that believes that if you're trying to get closer to God, you're fine. I mean, unless it's just ridiculous. If your intent is good, I think that it's fine. And I think that there is some real virtue at following the directions as closely as you can. And the virtue is that we are taking instruction from someone else instead of building our own. So I knew about people. I mean, I think I resented pretty much everyone I'd ever met. I would find ways to resent you. That was when I was drinking, one of the first things I'd do is figure out why I ought to be mad at you, which explained the fact that I didn't have many friends. And so I wrote this whole long list of people, and I'll write that list. I'll write the whole first column first. And then I'll write down the cause in the third column next. And then I'll write the fourth column after that, usually on a different piece of paper. Institutions are schools, jails, courts, anything that's part of government, the military, whatever. So almost everyone writes people. Some people write institutions, and almost no one writes principles. Yeah. Mm-hmm.